This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The first book Paul Allen read nonstop, cover to cover, was The Wonderful Trip to the Mushroom Planet.
Two boys build their own rocket and get to take it to this undiscovered planet nobody's ever been to before except the inhabitants.
The Bloomington man's 8-year-old experience has shaped his life and a new book on author Eleanor Cameron. Plus, ISU's 3-Minute Thesis Competition has a number of interesting presentations from young researchers. GLTs grow, and Judy Valente takes us into the woods. And a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from country financial representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Author Eleanor Cameron was passionate about what kids should read, expressing herself in both the children's books she wrote and as an early critic of children's literature. That passion ignited the imaginations of aspiring writers and raised the ire of one noted children's author. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more, with a local writer who reveals the woman behind the books in a new biography he hopes keeps Cameron from fading away out of memory.
Paul Allen was just 8 years old when he discovered the works of author Eleanor Cameron. He was perusing the stacks of the Bloomington Public Library when The Wonderful Flight to the Mushroom Planet, with its colorful cover and sci-fi bent, caught his eye.
That was the first book I remember not being able to put down. Like, I had to finish it.
So it was cover to cover.
Yeah, so I laid there in bed that night and read the whole thing.
All through the night?
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure your parents weren't too happy about that.
I don't know if they knew, but it was, when it's not a short book. So I think that was also a blossoming of my reading skills. Like, it was probably the first time that I was able to do that with a book, too.
So what was it about Eleanor Cameron that really caught your imagination? Was it her storytelling? Was it the fact that it had more of a sci-fi bent? What was it about Eleanor Cameron that excited you as a reader?
The plot of the book is these two boys build their own rocket and get to take it to this undiscovered planet nobody's ever been to before except the inhabitants.
Which is, of course, something we all want to do.
Yeah, and it's a very kid-empowering book because they have help from sort of this magical grandfatherly sort of being called Mr. Bass. But for the most part, they do it all themselves. And as a kid, that was just something that really spoke to me, that, like, you can do this yourself. And then they have this great little adventure while they're there, and that aspect spoke to me as well.
Well, you haven't left Eleanor Cameron behind. You've written a biography about her, but you didn't set out to do that. Actually, you thought, well, I'm just going to do a little reading on her, learn more about her as an author. First of all, why did you decide to do that after all these years?
I'm teaching 7th grade reading intervention, and I would introduce myself to my classes by saying, here are some books that meant a lot to me throughout my life. And it was sort of a way for them to get to know me, but also to show the importance of reading. And I would always talk about that book. And one of my students raised his hand and said, have you read the other books by Eleanor Cameron? And I said, no. And he said, why not?
He gotcha.
And I said, that's a good question. So that set me off on starting to just look more into her career. I'd known there were other books, but I didn't really know the extent of it. So I just started poking around and was surprised that even with the internet now, still not much out there about her. There was a little bit more, but not that much. And so I just started trying to track down her books and just learn about who she was.
So you started digging up information about her.
Yeah.
But you had, at that point, still no intention of writing a biography. Where did the idea for a biography come from?
Part of it was the dearth of information out there. There's nothing there. And I thought, well, this is, it's rare you find undiscovered country. I feel like, especially in someone who published 20 books and was fairly prominent in her field, that nobody has really tackled this. And that was sort of like a surprise to me. And so I went, just started doing some deep digging on the internet, and I found in one of my searches, just sort of randomly, not even looking for this, the Eleanor Cameron papers listed.
It's like an archive.
Yeah, an archive. So it said, you know, letters, manuscripts, various other ephemera from her career had been donated to the University of Minnesota. At that time, I was living in St. Paul, so it was a mile from my house where this archive was. So it was one of those.
It was a sign.
Yeah, it was one of those serendipitous moments that, you know, if that hadn't been so close with having my youngest son was 6 months old, there was no way that I was probably going to travel and do an extended study somewhere else in the country. But the fact that it was so close allowed me to go start going through those 15 boxes worth of items at the Curlin Collection at the University of Minnesota. It was somewhat organized, but clearly nobody had really gone through it since her death.
So, Paul, what made Eleanor unique as a children's author?
One of the main things was the range of what she wrote. Her first children's book was a science fiction book, and that's The Wonderful Flight to the Mushroom Planet, and then she started doing sequels to that. But she pretty quickly moved away into more fantasy-oriented, less science fiction, more fantasy, and then even toward time travel sort of books, and then toward realistic fiction based on her own childhood, still for children, but sort of drawing from her own childhood experiences. And then the other thing is the fact that she was a critic as well. So she developed in the mid-60s into children's, she started writing essays about children's literature.
And that was unusual for somebody who actually writes in the genre to be a critic of it as well.
Yeah, not something that happens very often. And it wasn't even, at that time, a genre that was being taken very seriously in an academic sense. It was just beginning to be that way. And so she was very much on the forefront of taking children's literature seriously as a scholarly pursuit. And she started to write these essays and travel around to conferences and deliver them. And it ended up in a book in 1969 of essays called The Green and Burning Tree, which a lot of professors and children's literature experts now point to as sort of a place where they first started to take children's literature seriously as an academic pursuit.
Well, her son described her as a fireball. She was not a woman who held back on her opinions, and she could be critical of other children's authors like Roald Dahl. She criticized Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Tell me about why she did that.
Well, she came from a very traditional view of children's literature. She wasn't a traditional person in her own personal views, but her view of children's literature was that the classics were what mattered most, and that teachers and parents should be reading the classics to their children. So it galled her somewhat to see that a book like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which she regarded as very like lightweight, she called it tasteless. She felt that that it was just a mean-spirited book, and she felt that teachers should not be reading this to children in their classes. And
so it was a book that sort of set a bad example and that kids shouldn't have that?
That was part of it. I mean, I think she was okay, and this was what kind of got lost and what happened subsequently. There was this furor in the pages of the Horn Book magazine about it was basically her versus Dahl and people
and
taking sides.
People went after her for this.
Yeah, and they went after her and kept going after her. Even in the years since, that kind of became how she was known, as the woman who tried to take down Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. But the nuance of her point was that she's okay with kids reading it themselves and finding it on their own, but that adults should set a better example for the kids in terms of what they're reading to them. And it was really a three-part essay that she had written for the Horn Book, and that was the first part. And there were two others that didn't talk about Roald Dahl or Charlie and the Chocolate Factory at all. It was sort of, she had a tendency to start with a straw man in her arguments, so she would set something up and then knock it down in the beginning and then kind of go on to what her more positive points were from there. So it got blown out of proportion in some ways, but she never regretted it because she loved that it created this great debate.
What is her lasting impact, do you think, Paul?
Probably the biggest two things would be The Wonderful Flight to the Mushroom Planet has had a huge impact on other authors, and I found several who would say that book as a kid just lit my imagination and made me think about building my own rocket and led me toward telling my own stories. And so people like Rodman Philbrick and Dan Yacirino and Lois McMaster Bujold, all of whom are authors now and fairly well known in their fields. And that book inspired a lot of readers. And her other books to a lesser extent, but I've started a website and a Facebook page and a Twitter account to try to connect with fans. And I get all sorts of different books that people come to me and say, this was my first one that just really spoke to me. So that part of it. And then her work as a critic as well, just trying to be part of or being part of that group that started to bring legitimacy to that field.
What do you hope to achieve with your biography, Paul?
Well, my main goal is to kind of reintroduce her into the conversation of children's literature. I think she kind of got forgotten, partly because she died in 1996 and her son died very soon after, and she had no other family left, and there was nobody to keep her legacy going. I feel like I'm kind of picking that back up in a way and putting her back out there for people to discover, and I really hope they would go back to her books and her main ideas that children's literature is a way to build empathy in people. She was especially passionate about the environment and preserving the natural world, and she thought that those messages could come across in children's books, not in a heavy-handed way. She didn't like books that had, like, and this is the moral, but she liked books that, you know, helped kids see a different perspective and, you know, change their behavior because of that.
That's Paul Allen, author of Eleanor Cameron, Dimensions of Amazement, which is currently available from the University Press of Mississippi. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Since 1992, the Eleanor Cameron Award has been given to authors who achieve excellence in children's science fiction.
Support for GLT comes from the BCPA, featuring The Freshman, a 1925 silent film starring comic genius Harold Lloyd with live organ accompaniment from Dennis Scott, Tuesday, March 20th. In this football comedy, Lloyd plays a college student struggling to fit in and find happiness. Tickets at artsblooming.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, GLTs grow. Graduate school is not just for researchers learning their trade. Young academics bring a lot of energy to their efforts, a lot of creativity, and in many cases, a lot of scholarship, good scholarship, does happen. Illinois State University holds a contest every year that challenges master's and graduate candidate and PhD candidates to talk about their research to a general audience in a limited time. It's called the 3-Minute Thesis Competition. It happened recently at the Normal Theater in Uptown, and we bring you some of the presentations now. Erica Rosenberger is from the College of Arts and Sciences.
What is your reaction when you hear the word feminist? You may be thinking of angry, pushy women wearing pink, cat-eared hats, shouting anti-male statements while burning bras on the side. Well, contrary to such stereotypes, feminists are actually just people who believe in gender equality regardless of gender, sex, ethnicity, etc. Past research has shown that feminists tend to be stigmatized, which means that they evoke negative reactions due to their group membership. Now think of a boyfriend of a feminist. You may have similar negative feelings towards this boyfriend. This transfer of negative feelings is called stigma by association. Stigma by association has been examined with other stigmas, such as the overweightness stigma. However, no one has looked at it with the feminist stigma yet. Therefore, I decided to look at the spread of the feminist stigma using a survey. In the first part, participants rated pictures of men with their girlfriends, as you can see up there, and their likelihood to pursue gendered activities. In the second part, the participants' unconscious sexism, which is also called implicit sexism, was measured using images. Participants saw pictures of men and women in jobs that were common or uncommon for men to work, followed by an abstract picture. For example, participants saw a female teacher, which is common, or a male nurse, which is uncommon, than a flash of abstract art, and they were told to only rate the abstract art. Research has shown that the participants' reactions to the first picture transfers to the abstract picture's ratings. Therefore, more implicitly sexist participants will rate the abstract art paired with the male nurse more negatively because they feel more uncomfortable. After analyzing the results, I found that men who were more implicitly sexist tended to take part in stereotyping. They tended to believe that the boyfriend of a typical girlfriend were more likely to have masculine interests such as engineering, which is expected of men, However, they believe that the feminist's boyfriends were more likely to have feminine interests, like theater. Like theater, yes. Exactly. But in the stereotyping actually was linked to believing that the feminist's boyfriend were unintelligent or stupid. And therefore, bottom line, I did find that the feminist stigma does transfer. Why do I care so much about this feminist stigma? Well, because of the stigma, people who also believe in gender equality don't really like to call themselves feminists. But there are some benefits to this label. For example, people who identify themselves as a feminist tend to actually be more outspoken and resilient when they experience sexual harassment, which then discourages the harasser from continuing such behaviors. I think it's time to empower people, and this label just might help. Thank you.
Erica Rosenberger from the College of Arts and Sciences. The three-minute thesis contest is not supposed to trivialize or dumb down research, but rather encourage students to consolidate ideas and crystallize research discoveries. Here is Perry Harlow from the College of Applied Science and Technology.
My mother always told me to never talk about money, religion, or politics with a new group of people. However, I'm going to have to apologize to my mom tonight because for the next 3 minutes, we're going to talk about two of them, money and politics. The political climate in Illinois has been rocky for the past couple of years. With the election of a Republican governor and the Democratic control of the state legislature caused a 793-day budget impasse. The governor was cutting programs that he didn't feel was essential for the state to run effectively, and the Democrats did not agree with him. This caused mental health facilities to close, state universities had to put employees on furlough, and education programs were being cut. One of those programs was agricultural education. The agricultural education line item in the state of Illinois provides funding for high school teachers, potential high school agriculture teachers, professional development, as well as increasing the program efficacy. Over 680,000 K through 12 students were affected by the line item in 2016. The line item has been cut three times from the state budget, but advocates for ag education kept pushing the state legislators and they put it back in the budget, but they were really concerned about it. So this is where my research comes in to help the problem. I have a mixed method research design where I started with the survey and I distributed it to all of the state legislators in the state of Illinois. We asked them where they grew up, how do they feel about school-based ag education, and how often they hear about it. We are also doing an interview portion after the survey. Only a few are going to be selected to participate, but we're going to ask them to elaborate how they feel about school-based ag education and agriculture. Our research questions are looking at the demographics of where they grew up and how they lived and compare it to the mean average of their school-based ag education number. We found out that there is a significance between the location of their district and how they view school-based ag education in the state of Illinois. We also found out from our data that there's a negative correlation between the people who lived on a farm and those who view agriculture education in urban areas. We're still doing the interviews and we're really excited to see the research. From the research, we're hoping that we can create a guide for agricultural education programs throughout the state of Illinois so they can better advocate for themselves to the state General Assembly. Thank you.
That's Perry Harlow of the College of Applied Science and Technology. Students in the three-minute thesis competition can use one static slide and no additional transitions, animation, video, or props. Presentations are all spoken word. They exclude songs and theatrical performances, though not theatrical delivery. The second place winner this year of the three-minute thesis competition at ISU is Tarini Mishwanath of the College of Arts and Sciences.
Have you heard of the Bechdel test? The rules are really simple. You need two female characters in any work of literature with names who talk to each other about something that's not men. How many books and films do you think pass this test? That's right, only a handful. Books and films inadvertently marginalize women, and children internalize this. As young girls grow into adulthood, they lose the voice they once had and they learn to give in to authority. In my dissertation, I do a close reading and analysis of children's and young adult literature to see what a feminist text looks like. Feminist literary scholars over the last 20 years or so have argued that for a book to be feminist, it needs to have a feminist protagonist who's able to speak out against oppression. I argue that it's not enough if the female protagonist merely speaks out. She must also be able to accept the agency generated by her body, because our bodies are in one way or another a response to the culture that we live in. I also argue that it's not enough for the female character to be strong by herself. No one can make a difference alone. The female character needs to have a close-knit community, a group of friends on whom she can depend. Of late, there's been an influx of strong female characters in children's and young adult literature, from Katniss Everdeen in The Hunger Games to Wonder Woman. But are these texts feminist enough? For the sake of time, I'll restrict myself to just one example. Katniss Everdeen is strong. She's resilient. She stages a revolution. But the books don't pass the Bechdel test. Katniss's two close female companions die, and towards the end of the novel, she's a broken shell of a person. She lives alone with her husband and two children, although motherhood is something she always claimed she didn't want. The underlying message of these books is very clear. As a young girl grows into adulthood, she needs to move away from the political sphere into the domestic. Katniss and Wonder Woman aren't merely just characters. They are role models. They inspire young girls and young readers to stand up for what they believe in. They start their own revolutions in their own ways. For instance, one young girl who read these books said that Katniss was like a sister to her, not just any other character. My dissertation, therefore, highlights the importance of having feminist novels, not just strong female characters, but friendships instead of caustic frenemies and love triangles, so our future generations grow into strong, successful women. Thank you.
Tarini Mishwanath of the College of Arts and Sciences, second place in the 3-minute thesis competition at ISU. She won a $700 prize. Tomorrow on Sound Ideas, hear the first place winner. Thanks to Totally Creative Video for the recordings of the speakers at the Normal Theater last month.
NPR One is a whole new way to listen.
I like that it mixes things for me automatically.
Catch up on NPR and GLT News. Customize the app for you.
It looks at the content that I'm looking at, I think. It feels like the thing is starting to anticipate things that I might like.
Share what you like. Skip what you don't. It's public radio made personal.
Hi, I'm Greg Kosorik from Bloomington, Illinois, and I listen to NPR One.
NPR One is at the Apple App Store and Google Play. Learn more at wglt.org/NPR1.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Bloomington Normal Sarah Kwa says her most recent album was a team effort with Oxide Lounge producer Tony Sanfilippo. When Kwa takes the stage tomorrow night at Jazz Up Front in downtown Bloomington, she'll be playing many songs from that album, which she debuted last year on GLT Sound Ideas. In this encore presentation of an interview with John Norton and Sanfilippo, tell us how the songs were crafted from Kwa's original inspiration.
The music so loud that the cells inside me fill out. That's how I'm feeling right now.
It's the second song on Sarah Kwa's brand new album called Taking Me Back. How I'm Feeling is the name of the song. Sarah Kwa, producer Tony Sanfilippo, welcome to the studios.
Thank you.
Sarah, you must be excited.
Yes, very.
How are you feeling about this album?
Well, we've been working on this for about a year, and it feels like the momentum is just growing and growing and growing daily, and I'm pretty much working as hard and fast as I can every day from the time I wake up until the moment I crash. So I'm ready for it to be here, but I also feel like it would be great if I had another month. to get everything ready and perfect.
Well, let's talk about the song itself. Tony, I will get to you.
Oh,
I'm going to stick with Sarah right now, though. Let's talk about the album. It's called Taking Me Back, and the song, How I'm Feeling.
Yeah.
It's like driving in the country on a beautiful summer afternoon.
So let me tell you how I wrote this song.
Okay.
I was rehearsing for the album. So we were on in the summer in the middle of recording, and I was driving home from rehearsal.
Where were you?
A beautiful night. I was on Clinton going north. Is that very specific?
It is. It's good. I like it.
I like that.
And
on the boulevard?
I was not quite there yet.
Okay.
I was right before that when I first got it. And I had the windows down. It was a beautiful summer night. And I felt really good about the rehearsal and just really excited about hanging out with the guys and how fun it was. And just really didn't want that to end and get home. And so I got that first verse and went home and finished it in like 10 minutes. It's how I'm feeling right now.
It's how I'm feeling right now. How I'm Feeling is the song. This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton with Sarah Quas and Tony Sanfilippo. You brought your producer with you. I'll let either one of you go, but how do you guys work together? Why are you guys working together? Why was it important to bring Tony up with you, Sarah?
Well, you answer that, and then I'll get into my bit.
Well, this is very much a partnership. I don't know if that's always the case, but we've become really good friends. I don't think that the album would be what it is if it was just my vision. It was my writing, but really, that's where the solo part ended, and it became this collaboration between the two of us. Because Tony has an amazing imagination.
Yeah, I have a pretty clear vision when I hear a song, and as we get to know each other, we had done an EP and three singles, I think, before this record happened. She can sit with her guitar on my couch in the control room and play me a song, and I can hear usually a couple different ways we can turn it into something different than, and whenever anybody's in my studio, to me, I'm joining the band at that time.
When you hear a song, like Sarah was talking about, being on the couch and just playing something, do you hear arrangements right away?
Oh, yeah.
Do you hear other instruments right away?
Absolutely.
Okay, all of that.
I can hear certain things to add, whether it should have solo or not, what type of keyboards we may or may not use, a drum groove usually, a rhythm section thing. I can hear a lot of things. And luckily, when it comes to harmonies and things like that, I can just say, okay, go sing a harmony and she'll sing one. And then I'll say, sing a higher harmony and she'll sing one. And I'll say, sing a lower harmony and she'll sing one. So we can do that pretty much all day long if we want.
How about if this? Give me an example of exactly what you were just talking about that turned out on this brand new album.
Physics, I knew I wanted to get my friend Treffin to come play the guitar solo, Treffin Owen. I think we messed around with right where the pocket felt in that song a lot. We played it a little bit faster and a little bit slower and things to really find the place it wanted to live, to have enough breath and enough life to it, but not either go by so fast that you didn't quite get the vibe or labor too long where it didn't portray what the lyrics were. Straight as the arrow that's notched in.
Little Bit is another song on the second half of the album. That's a catchy little number.
Yes, it
I think
is.
That's the biggest earworm of the record.
Oh, yeah. That, if there's a hit on the record, that's the obvious one.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. Tony, you agree, don't you? You called it an earworm.
I'm laughing for a number of reasons, including the fact that...
That there are no hits anymore?
Well, there's that. Okay. But when you produce vinyl, which this record is available on vinyl... You have a limited time per side, and if you try and put more on there, you lose low end and lose volume and lose a lot of sound qualities and have a lot more surface noise and all kinds of things like that. So the vinyl cutter, the mastering engineer for the vinyl side of it is a good friend of mine named Jeff Powell in Memphis, Tennessee, who works out of Sam Phillips Recording. Powell called me up and said, dude, side B is really kind of long, and the sides don't match in length, so I'd have to make side A as soft as side B. Is there anything we can do? Blah, blah, blah. And I knew almost immediately that we could pull that song off side B of the vinyl because Sarah still is in church. It'd be on the record.
One romantic line happens all the time. Strangers on the sidewalk driving blind. I gotta make you fall in love with me a little bit.
So well, that's the technical side of it. What? Tell me about the song itself.
It's just not my favorite song on the album.
Why? It's a little bit different than the rest of the songs on the album.
Yeah. I feel bad, like, not, like, but it just feels a little, it's a little bit catchy. It's a little bit like a theme song, and I wrote it in a little bit of a sassy mood.
I think that's why people connect to it.
I was writing about when you're, you know, you're out and you're performing and you're on the street or whatever, you're, like, doing the best that you can, and you've done all this preparation, and people just walk right by you and don't even notice you, and it just hurts your feelings, and you try to, like, let it just go, and sometimes you're like, oh, how can I make you hear me? How can I make you see me? He might not remember saying it to me, but it's Mike Gardner, who played on the album, said to me, you got to make people fall in love with you. And at first I was a little bit, like, weirded out by that. I don't like the idea of being flirtatious or, you know, trying to get people to be fake with people. That's not who I am. But I pondered over it for a while, and I kind of decided he's kind of right.
Make it impossible.
Sarah Kwa and producer Tony Sanfilippo with GLT's John Norton about Kwa's latest album, Taking Me Back. Kwa returns to Jazz Up Front in downtown Bloomington tomorrow night. Music starts at 7 p.m. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a trip into the woods. Your trees stand a better chance of thriving once you know every bit of your plant. Patrick Murphy has details on this edition of GLT's Grow.
Knowing what's what on your tree can help you take better care of your plant. I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert in the field, from the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. It's Patrick Murphy. Hello, Murph.
Hello, Laura.
Today on GLT's Grow, tree lingo and its importance. So we need to know what makes up our friends, the trees.
I thought it was important to maybe go over a few of the more regularly encountered ones that you might see when you're reading a tag on a tree at the nursery,
mm-hmm.
or you're talking to the landscape designer who's coming over to your house to help develop a criteria for your new landscaping project. Or if you're a student studying anything in the landscaping industry, such as forestry, irrigation, a tree care professional, nursery professionals, they all kind of use some of these terms. And it gives you a better understanding of trees, I think, too.
So you can take care of them better if you understand them better.
You can understand them much better. Knowledge is power, for sure. So we can work from the top down.
Okay.
And crown is a term, refers to the above ground parts that begin to organize above where the trunk ends. So the crown consists of limbs, branches, and twigs. And so the hierarchy on that limbs, branches, and twigs is kind of goes like this. Limbs are the scaffold. Limbs are the big aerial trunks, if you will. Sometimes they can start very close to the ground, as they often do in nature. But sometimes plants are selected with the low limbs because it has a certain type of screening or fullness effect that presents differently in the landscape. So limbs are the scaffold. The branches are where there is a division. So the limb will split into branches, and at the ends of those branches, their little guys are the twigs. That's where the floral buds, the fruit, the leaves, that's where that's all happening.
Okay.
Twigs that come right off of, leaves and things that come right off the branches, other advantageous twigs that come off the branches, those are suckers or water sprouts. They can occur on the limb or they can occur down at the bottom where the tree comes out of the ground.
Now, I'm under the impression that if they occur down at the bottom, that's not healthy.
Well, I think it depends on what the conditions are. So if you have a tree and the top of it's sick and all of a sudden you're getting these lower advantageous growth off of the lower stump, yeah, that's a problem.
Okay.
But otherwise, trees grow that way.
Oh.
Trees grow that way and man cuts them off so it doesn't interfere with his horse riding or his lawn mowing, right? Man. And then the trunk below all of these limbs, branches, and twigs, it starts at the ground and can go up into the crown before terminating. And the little spot where it kind of starts out of the ground and it starts big and ends small,
mm-hmm.
I've heard it described as an elephant's foot. I think that's a great way to look
yeah.
at it. That's the basal flare. The basal flare is where the bottom of the trunk flares out into the ground.
The basal flare.
And the basal flare is something of character that we all admire. Some trees, again, it's a characteristic that's very attractive. And slow-growing, hard trees oftentimes have dramatic basal flares. If that's an area of the tree, you don't want to bury or anything like that. But on with the lingo. On with the lingo.
Okay.
So the trunk is measured with an abbreviation called DBH, which is diameter at breast height. That's 5 feet off the ground for you and me.
Okay.
Okay. So if you were to come to the Fell Arboretum and you are invited, it is free, it is yours if you pay taxes, you will see that many of the tags are hung at 5 feet off the ground, and that's right where the ground and the trunk are at, you know, because some trees, they kind of mound up over time or they were planted high, but the 5 feet is from the ground at the base of the trunk, somewhere at a point 5 feet off the ground on the trunk.
So like maybe roughly where your breastbone could be.
It's okay. Shoulder height for me.
Okay. You're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening show for those who like to get their hands dirty. This week, understanding tree lingo.
So we were talking about that diameter at breast height. That's measured in feet and inches or meters and centimeters if you're in Europe. And it is a great way to make it quick, easily reachable determination of the tree's rate of growth. It's a great measurement. It's a measurement that's also used in forestry to determine the volume and value of timber. It's used in the landscape and nursery industry because a lot of times they sell trees by the inch of diameter. So you get a 1-inch tree, a 1 1/4-inch tree, a 1 1/2-inch tree, et cetera, et cetera.
I gotcha.
They should do a Schoolhouse Rock thing about that.
They should.
So now that we've come down the trunk, we're at the basal flare, we can talk about the roots. Some of the lingo that you can run into with roots is a tap root. Not all trees have them. There was an understanding in the past that every tree had this big, long, candle-like root that was running down into the earth to hold it to the ground.
Oh.
Some trees have it. Not all trees do.
Oh.
It's more uncommon than it is common. Your roots kind of behave like the limbs, branches, and twigs do. So some of the roots hold the trees to the ground. Those are buttress roots. They start where the basal flare disappears into the ground. And at the ends of those root runs are the little feeder roots that are like human hair, that they absorb the water and they absorb the nutrients. And they connect with other trees and living plants and living things through a network called mycelium.
Mycelium.
Mycelium, yeah, right. And they sometimes call this horizon in the soil the mycorrhizae. Mycorrhizae.
Oh,
I love
that's
it.
Cool.
You know, it's like there's a whole other world right under your feet, you know.
And it's important to keep that area healthy.
It is. And it's also where all of these trees of different kinds and the woody plants and the herbaceous plants, this is fascinating. This is where they all connect. This is where they all meet. This is where they all become one.
Wow.
Part of some ecosystem, okay? So think about that when you're playing overhand jarts, okay? Now, the rest of the roots understanding, it has changed in our lifetime. There used to be a kind of a misconception that the roots ended where the branches ended. So the crown where the branches end, that's the drip line. That's the drip line. But we now know that the roots can go far past the drip line and up to miles away.
To what?
Right.
Miles
right.
away?
So there are roots that are about the size of a number 2 pencil or your pinky.
Mm-hmm.
that have been found to have traveled over a mile away from red oaks, white oaks. This has been studied on many campuses, many arboretums. They're going to go with gravity, and they're going to go with and where there's water.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
So it's just not the case that they stop there. You can see lots of drawings and art where the roots below ground are a reflection of what's going on with the branches above ground. That's partly true. Some of the architecture may be the same, but it may not be, right?
I always thought it was that way. That's mind-blowing to me.
It's another thing. All that's seen and unseen, it's just fascinating. Now, we've talked about the basic components of the tree, and with the little bit of time we have left to visit, I thought we could talk about three, I think, kind of interesting and fun horticultural vocabulary terms.
Oh, I love vocab.
First is the drupe, spelled D-R-U-P-E, not D-R-O-O-P, but a drupe is a stone fruit, like a peach or cherry, an olive or a walnut, and a Cornelian cherry dogwood has them. They look like red jelly beans. A pulse. Those are peas, beans, and lentils, and those are the edible seeds of legumes. So mind your pulse and your drupe, and you're going to go farther as you shop for and take care of your trees.
Okay, some great advice there. Thank you, Murph, so much. Next week, we're going to be taking a couple of great questions about grub treatments and gardening tools, and we would love your gardening questions as well. Go to wglt.org/grow, fill in the form, and send it along to us. Submit those questions at wglt.org/grow.
You can download the Grow Podcast Weekly at iTunes and wglt.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Stephen Sondheim is known for his dark, ironic treatment of life and love. Those themes come through in the Community Players staging of a production of the musical Into the Woods. GLT's Judy Valente has more with Illinois State University Associate Dean Sally Perry, who's directing this reimagining of some of the best-known fairy tales.
Into the woods, but not too fast, or what you wish you lose at last.
Into the woods, but mind the past.
What happens to Cinderella after she marries her prince? Who is Rapunzel's real mother? And is every witch bad? Is every hero good? These are some of the questions that arise in Stephen Sondheim's musical Into the Woods, which opened on Broadway in 1987 and became a feature film in 2014. As usual, Sondheim's lyrics drip with irony and pathos. Sally Perry, who is directing the Community Players production, calls the show one of Sondheim's best.
The reason is I think that it strikes a nice balance between having a number of themes and also music that a wider audience can relate to. Some of his other shows are a little bit darker. One of the things about Into the Woods is that there are a number of conflicts, but they're resolved in interesting ways, in ways in which I think the audience feels more comfortable with, say, than with the Sweeney Todd or Passion, for example.
This isn't exactly a fairy tale show for your children.
Well, you know, it's the first act is pretty much the fairy tales that one remembers. Little Red Riding Hood meets the wolf, defeats the wolf, rescues Granny, that sort of thing. Jack of Jack and the Beanstalk climbs up the beanstalk, comes back with a golden harp and golden eggs and lots of money. What makes it interesting is the second act. In the second act, it's what happens after Happily Ever After. And I think that's where a lot of the audience is going to find it very intriguing because, you know, you figure Cinderella meets her prince, they fall in love, they get married. But then what happens? There are consequences for what happens to all of the characters. You know, if Jack is stealing money from the giant's house, well, they're going to miss the money. If the giant falls down the beanstalk and dies, there's a Mrs. Giant. She's not very happy about this whole thing. I won't give it away, but Cinderella's prince is perhaps not all he's cracked up to be.
Right, we won't give that away because we'll leave some surprises.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very nice prince. And it's a very nice ball. And when I entered, they trumpeted. And the prince.
Oh, the prince?
Yes, the prince.
Well, he's tall.
Is that all?
And the witch is not all bad either. The witch who's sort of the nemesis in Act 1, you can have some sympathy for her when you get to know her a little bit better in Act 2.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think that when people think witches, they think just sort of evil hags or something like that. But the witch in Into the Woods, she loves her child, Rapunzel, and she'll do anything for her. Now, of course, in which terms she decides she wants to keep Rapunzel away from the rest of the world, so she puts her in a high tower. But it's not as a punishment. It's because she wants to keep her child safe, something that I think that we can all kind of identify with. Now, of course, in the second act, Rapunzel realizes that being stuck in a tower for the rest of her life is not really a good thing to be, and wants her freedom. So in the second act, we actually see some tension between the daughter who wants to become an adult and the witch who doesn't want to let her child go.
It's almost in that second act where you see the characters you're introduced to in Act One change and grow.
Absolutely. And I think it leaves a lot of food for thought. So I think it's actually a good show for parents and children, because sometimes parents make decisions that their children disagree with. And as you grow older, you say, I can see why you may have done that. I may not agree with it, but being an adult means making decisions and accepting the consequences for those decisions.
There's some tremendous ballads in this show, even though there's a lot of lighthearted songs and songs that relate to the fairy tale stories. There's some beautiful ballads like Children Will Listen.
Yes.
Once upon a time, in a far-off kingdom, there lived a young maiden, a sad young lad. Child was baker with his wife.
Children will listen, and this is a theme that shows up in a number of Sondheim's musicals. The idea that children are not quite as naive as we think they are, and that as adults, if we do things, the children are going to be listening. The children are more aware of what their parents are doing than I think parents realize. And also that when one is thinking about children, sometimes I think we're kind of short-sighted about what their possibilities are. And so for the witch, it's a way of sort of reflecting on our own situation as well as speaking to the wider community within the Into the Woods group.
Now, of course, it's been a musical, it's been a film just
yes.
a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Are you doing anything slightly different? Are you trying to put your own imprimatur, so to speak, on the production?
Well, I think that everybody who does it a little bit differently. One of the things that I'm really interested in is the connections between the characters. Because in the first act, people end up in with paired off with somebody usually. Cinderella has her prince, Rapunzel has her prince, and so forth. In the second act, what I find very interesting and what I kind of want to stress is that the families get broken apart. Some people die because of the giant or for other reasons, but then the families get remade. And I think it's really interesting to think about the whole idea of family not being just sort of a blood relation, but communities that we make together. And I think that the real power of the show comes from the way that community is created in the second act.
And then you have that beautiful song that kind of brings it all together toward the end, No One Is Alone.
Yes, absolutely.
And he says, truly, no one is alone. He keeps repeating that.
Mother cannot guide you.
Yes, and it's wonderful the way it sort of echoes, and it echoes among the different characters. Everybody, the main characters that are left at the end of the show, they all feel alone. One has lost a grandmother, one's lost a spouse, one's lost a mother, and they all do feel very abandoned. And the power of that song is not only does it reflect their feelings, but it also gives them a realization that family or community can be remade. You have to think about it, and you have to put aside some preconceptions about who you belong with. But in thinking about it, you say to yourself, okay, well, perhaps there are other places, other communities that I can belong to. I don't have to stay by myself, but you have to work at it. And I think that's one of the issues for all of the characters, and something that I think the audience will want to take away as well.
Sally Perry is the director of the new production of Into the Woods by Community Players, starting March 9th. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Judy Valente.
There is a Pay What You Can preview of Into the Woods at Community Players in Bloomington tomorrow night. The show runs Fridays through Sundays through March 25th. Here from the original Broadway cast album of Is Giants in the Sky.
And you know things now that you never knew before. Not till the sky. Only just when you've made a friend and all, and you know she's big, but you don't feel small. Someone bigger than her comes along the hall to swallow you for lunch. And your heart is lead and your stomach's stone, and you're really scared being all alone.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, with help today from Judy Valente, Laura Kennedy, and John Norton. Find the full show podcast and individual stories and interviews at WGLT.org. Try the NPR One app for GLT and NPR News. Get the app from Google Play or the Apple App Store. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. You can even call and leave a message about Sound Ideas at 309-438-WGLT. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
You're back again, only different than before. After the sky, there are giants in the sky. There are big, tall, terrible.
This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
In the sky.